Hi, I'm Lisa Levin.
And I'm Julie Sapper.
We're the co-founders of Run Farther and Faster and co-hosts of the podcast under the same name.
Well, we started this podcast as a Boston Marathon-focused podcast based on the experiences from our combined 31 finishes. We cover all things running-related.
We've coached runners of all levels and goal distances all over the world for over 13 years.
Thanks so much for joining us. We are so excited you're here.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Run Farther and Faster podcast. It's just me, Julie, this week doing our intro. Lisa will be back next week. And we're really excited about our guest this week. We've actually talked about this guest on our podcast before. He's author Brad Stahlberg. And Brad recently wrote a phenomenal book, which we absolutely loved. It's called Master of Change: How to Excel When Everything is Changing, Including You. And this was a terrific book because it's not a self-help book at all. It's a book about how we can view change as simply part of life. And when we have the right tools to navigate change, we accept it and we're able to move through it, even when change is negative. And as far as change as it applies to running, changes such as injury or simply just getting older are changes that, if we're prepared for them and we look at it as part of our running journey, those changes can cause our running journey to be a lot more positive than negative. And often where we run into difficulty is when we try to resist change or when we look at change as something that's negative. And Brad talks a lot about this. And without going too deep into the book, when I read the book, I really felt like it created a shift in my mindset, not just as it applies to running in general, but also to other elements of my life, including parenting, because kids grow up and that automatically, of course, causes changes. That's what we're supposed to do as parents, but that change can be very difficult. So Brad's tools and the stories he shares within his book are really terrific, and they really helped me sort of look at change a little differently. We referenced his book in our episode last week a little bit when we gave the analogy of rooms and how it's important to have many interests, and the analogy is many rooms in your house. So if one interest isn't going so well, you have other rooms to go into. And when things start to go awry, it's when you live in a house with only one room. So someone, for example, who is singularly focused on their career and nothing else, or singularly focused on running and nothing else, that's when, if a change in that happens, such as an injury, one can really spiral as a result of not having other rooms. So this was a really great conversation, and we hope you get a lot out of it, not just about how it applies to running, but also how it applies to your life. So a little bit about Brad. Brad researches, writes, and coaches on mental health, well-being, and sustainable excellence. Brad is a former distance runner, a talented distance runner, and a former football player. And he himself underwent some injury. He had compartment syndrome and wasn't able to run anymore. And he was eventually able to take his interest in sport and apply it to strength training. And now he's a power lifter. So in addition to being an athlete, Brad is a best-selling author of another book, The Practice of Groundedness, along with his most recent book, Master of Change. He regularly contributes to the New York Times, and his work has been featured in the Wall Street Journal and the Atlantic, among other outlets. In his coaching practice, he works with executives, which he talks a little bit about on our podcast. It was very interesting. Entrepreneurs, physicians, and athletes on their mental skills and overall well-being. He's on faculty at the University of Michigan School of Public Health, and his past books also include Peak Performance and The Passion Paradox. He also co-hosts a terrific podcast with Steve Magnus, and he can be found on Instagram and Twitter under B or Brad Stahlberg. So next week, Lisa will be back, but we hope you really enjoy this episode. We certainly enjoyed talking to Brad. It was quite an enlightening conversation. And while I still have your attention, just a quick reminder that tickets are available for our event, Whoever Lives Local, at the JCC in Rockville. We are hosting past podcast guest Christine Yu, who wrote a phenomenal book as well called Up to Speed, The Groundbreaking Science of Women Athletes. Christine is from New York, and she's coming down to the DC area to do a book talk and signing with us at the JCC on Sunday, October 22nd at 10:30 a.m. Tickets are linked on all of our social media, and we'll also put it in the show notes. Tickets are just a donation of any amount that you decide you want to give, which will be donated to Camp Lessons, an inclusion camp for kids at the JCC, and also the Maccabi Games, Maccabi USA. So if you have any questions about the event, please don't hesitate to reach out to us. We hope to see many folks there. It's going to be a great discussion. And without further delay, here is Brad Stahlberg. Have a great week. Brad Stahlberg, welcome to the Run Farther and Faster podcast. We are so excited that you're joining us today. So before we get into the nitty-gritty of your new book, why don't we start out by having you introduce yourself and a little bit about what you like to do for fun and what you do professionally.
All right. So what I do for fun is I am the parent of a 5.5-year-old son, a 10-month-old daughter, a 2.5-year-old German Shepherd, and an 8- and 7-year-old cat. And I'm the husband of a lovely 36-year-old wife. So most of my fun time is family time. I also am an athlete. My current athletic pursuit is strength training, in particular powerlifting. I love hiking. We live in the Blue Ridge Mountains, so we're very fortunate that there's a lot of great hiking around here. And I also love coffee and reading books. Professionally, I wear a couple of hats. The first is as an author of books on applied philosophy and applied psychology. I'm also a coach where I work with athletes, entrepreneurs, and physicians on their mental game. And I'm an adjunct professor at the University of Michigan School of Public Health.
So before we get into your books, can you explain a little bit about your coaching and a little bit about how you got to that point where you're coaching executives? Because you have an athletic background. So you can kind of explain how you got there and what exactly you do for corporate executives.
Sure. So that's right. I do have an athletic background. Predominantly in football, although following school, I had a good 10-year stint in endurance sports. Was never good enough to be professional or anything like that, but was like a decent amateur. So sports have always been a part of my life. In my first book, Peak Performance, which I co-authored with Steve Magnus, that came out, I want to say in 2016, so almost a decade ago. And maybe it was 2017. Anyways, a long time ago. And people really love that book. And a big part of what people love from that book is we took a lot of principles that apply to training for sport and said, actually, when you look at the recent research in psychology and sociology and other human performance fields, these same principles apply outside of sport too. So after that book came out, people just started asking me if I would coach them. And at the time, I had no idea that there was even a thing as coaching. I thought coaching was just for athletes. But I was living in the Bay Area in San Francisco, which is really where kind of performance coaching for non-athletes took off. And it was at that time. So I met with a few other people who were coaches, who were really well-respected coaches. They were professors at Stanford. So they had their academic chops too. And I said, you know, I'm very curious what you think. And they said, you should try it. You should see if you like it. So I took on a few clients at first. I didn't charge anything. I just wanted to understand if I would like it. And since then, my coaching practice has grown, where now, in addition to my writing, it's just what I do professionally.
And Brad, what was your background in college and like what, you know, you studied and how did that translate into what you do now?
In undergraduate school, I studied organizational behavior, which at my program was a combination of psychology, economics, and sociology. And then I went out and I worked for a few years, and then I went back to graduate school where I studied public health. And it was in public health school that I realized that I was less interested in the healthcare system and what to do when people become sick, either physically or psychologically, and more interested in how to keep people not only disease-free, but flourishing in their lives.
I'm just curious, can you tell us, without, of course, revealing any confidential information, what are some of the problems that you repeatedly see among corporate executives who seek you for coaching?
Oh, they're the same problems that we all have. Time management, prioritization, how to maintain healthy habits while pushing real hard in a work setting, how to cultivate community and belonging. Sometimes it's just to have a confidant that they can tell things to that they can't really tell anyone else because they're having to make decisions that they can't yet share with other people at their organization. So they truly can't have a sounding board. And sometimes it's just playing that role. Sometimes it is nutrition and sleep habits. So there's nothing too out of the ordinary, at least not in the people that come to me.
You ever have imposter syndrome? We're kind of asking this selfishly because.
Yeah, all the time.
Okay. So how do you get through that?
I think that I've realized that if you don't have some imposter syndrome, that's probably like a more dangerous sign. I think that is the path to like becoming a kind of know-it-all guru grifter that generally ends up like in prison these days, it seems. So I view that feeling of insecurity and imposter syndrome is a sign that like I still have my skin in the game in a very authentic, real way. And I've just learned to take that for the ride. And I've learned that it's okay to have doubts and have imposter syndrome and to still be the expert on a topic while having those doubts and having that imposter syndrome. So I think imposter syndrome, when it becomes debilitating, when you can't do the thing or you feel like you're severely underperforming, is something to work on and something to try to correct. But I think that like little doubt or that, how did I get here? Why are all these people listening to me? Or do I really know what I'm talking about? I think those are actually signs of being an expert.
That's reassuring because, as Julie said, you know, I think all of us go through that. And I think those of us also who have high expectations of ourselves probably are subject to that more. So that is reassuring to hear. I think you're right. It keeps us humble and it keeps us striving and learning. So I'm curious to know what prompted you to write this, your most current book on change? What really kind of triggered that, and what demand did you see for that type of book?
Yeah, I think that it's a little bit of everything. So, and that's kind of the thesis of the book, that change is a little bit of everything. It's always happening. In my personal life, I went through significant changes in the last couple of years. If you give it a 6-year window, I became a father for the first time, became a father for the second. And this is not in order. Became a father for the first time, became a father for the second time, moved across the country, suffered an injury that took me out of running, which had been an outsized part of my identity for years, left my corporate ties to go at it full time as an author and just this small private coaching practice, on and on and on. And then there's the pandemic, which is this massive change that all of us underwent and lived through. So change was on my mind. I distinctly remember reading newspaper headlines in mid-2021. So we'd been living with the pandemic for better part of a year, almost a year and a half. And all these headlines were written in the spirit of, when are things going to get back to normal? And something about that just bothered me. And I didn't really even know what at the time, but it was enough to start this intellectual journey of learning how people respond to change, why they do, alternative models for thinking about change, so on and so forth. And then I came across Bruce Feiler's research that shows that the average adult experiences 36 major changes in their life. And at first I couldn't believe it, but then I started counting in my own life and I like age rated it and I'm like, oh yeah, I'm on pace for 40. And yet we think that change is the exception, not the rule. We think the change is something that happens to us, not something that is like an ongoing conversation that we're always in. So generally for me, if there's a topic that I'm really interested in, if other people seem to be interested in, and if I have more questions than answers about, it's worth exploring for a potential long article, if not book. And that's what happened here.
So when you started writing this book, because you were writing a book in the middle of all of the changes that you were undergoing, including a global change, how did that process actually change you?
I think in a couple of main ways. I think the first is realizing that there's no going back to how things were after a change. and really understanding why that mindset is so pervasive. It comes from what scientists call homeostasis, or this concept that we have for describing change is a cycle of order, disorder, back to order, which has been the prevailing model of change for the last couple of centuries, but turns out not to be very accurate, not to be what researchers would call a good fit model. And more recently, the scientific community has moved on to a model for change called allostasis, which describes change as a cycle of order, disorder, reorder. So yes, we like stability, but that stability is always somewhere new. And just having that language to be able to say like, oh, I'm in the disorder phase, or I'm in the disorder phase and I'm longing for order, but order is gone. Like I have to create what the reorder is. That conceptual framework has been really helpful. And then this construct that I call rugged flexibility has also been really helpful, that essentially says that in order to navigate change really well, the goal is not just to be rugged, not just to be strong, determined, durable, nor is the goal just to be flexible, to be soft, supple, to go with the flow. The goal is to be both rugged and flexible, and to hold both of those ideas at the same time, and to realize that you tend to have some agency throughout change, and it might not be as much as you think, it might not be as much as you want, but there's some agency that you can use, and then there's also a lot of letting go, and those two things can coexist, whereas I used to think it was one or the other, either like you had agency or you didn't, and now I've learned it's almost always both and.
You know, something you said really resonates with me, and that is, in your book you talk about it a lot, of course, and that is the homeostasis versus the allostasis, and the reorder versus the order after change. And there are hundreds of articles right now in the media about how corporations and government are demanding that people come back in the office. And that really struck me as I was reading your book a few weeks ago, because that's exactly what they're not doing. They're not acknowledging what has happened, how people can work in different ways. And they're basically just, to me, these executives seem to be having almost a temper tantrum, like you need to come back, because they just want that order back. And just going off topic slightly, I just want to hear your thoughts on that.
I think it's a really prime example of trying to get back to how things were and not recognizing that that ship has sailed, and that's likely impossible. It's not to say that it will be all remote for every job everywhere always. It will likely be something in between. And that gets to like this other core term in the book, right? Rugged flexibility. So like, you know, in an organizational sense, it's like, well, what are your sources of ruggedness? Like what really make the organization what it is? And for very few organizations is that people showing up to the office 5 days a week. So then you have to determine, well, and I think it's like a cop-out. It's easy to say that's what makes the organization special, but you know, if you're a trauma surgeon or a transplant surgeon, that's definitely true. But for knowledge work, nuh-uh. So then the question is, all right, well then what is it that's really core about like the work, and then how can we flexibly apply that? And maybe that's a hybrid approach. Maybe that is going fully remote. But I think like the whiplash, just get back to how things were, is a recipe for disaster. With the exception of some fields, hardware engineering. You know, if you're making parts to cars, like there are some fields. But the accounting firm that's like everyone needs to be in the office 5 days a week, it's like good luck recruiting.
Yeah, and how do you translate that to athletes? So athletes who may be going through changes, whether it's an injury and like you experienced, like Julie has experienced, kind of that, how do you apply, or aging? We see that a lot with our athletes as they're aging and there's change. Like how do you apply that concept of rugged flexibility to an athlete that's going through changes?
All right. Yeah, let's dive in. This will be the meat of our conversation, I'd imagine. So a couple of things. The first is I want to start with the story of Niels Vanderpool, who is a Swedish speed skater who won the gold medal and silver medal in the 2022 Winter Olympic Games. And he also shattered the world record. So he's the best long course speed skater to ever set foot on this planet, and likely will be for a very long time. In the lead up to the 2022 games, however, Vanderpool felt that he was underperforming a bit. And he identified fear as the main thing that was holding him back. He felt a whole lot of fear when he went into the speed skating oval to compete. And then he asked himself, well, why am I feeling this fear? And what he realized is that his entire sense of self, his self-confidence, his self-worth, his entire identity was that of a speed skater. So if you took away speed skater, there was no Niels Vanderpool. He was completely fused with the sport. And he realized that that made him really fragile to change because injuries happen, illnesses happen, missteps happen. The competition showing up and skating their minds off happens. And he realized that having that complete identity fusion with his sport really made him very fragile. So in the lead up to the 2022 games, where he just absolutely crushed it, he did something very unconventional for a world-class athlete, which is he took a completely normal weekend. So Friday night to Monday morning, Niels Vanderpool did nothing that had to do with the sport of speed skating. So he went out for pizza and beers with his friends. He went hiking. He started reading books. He got involved in his community. And he developed these other sources of meaning and identity in his life. And as a result of that, he was able to shed so much of that pressure and fear, and he could skate from a place of joy. And I think that what's true for Niels Vanderpool is true for any athlete at any level, which is when our identity gets too fused to a sport, we inherently become fragile, because if you compete in a sport for long enough, you will experience times when you are injured. You will experience times when you make missteps, and you will experience a inflection point in your career where your performance starts suffering due to age. This is true for every sport. It's true for both sexes. It's just how it goes. So then the question becomes, well, how do we live in this paradox where we care really deeply about the sport, where we want to be a part of the running community, where we want a PR, where we want to give it the best that we can, while at the same time not becoming overly attached to it? And the metaphor that I like to use here is to think of your identity like a house. And I think this is one of the most powerful parts of the book. So if you have a house and that house only has one room in it, and that room catches fire or it floods, you're screwed. Like, it is going, you're going to be underwater or on fire. It's not going to be a good situation. But if that house has a couple rooms, well, then you can go seek refuge in some of those other rooms while you sort out the flood or the fire. And I like to think of building an identity like building a house. So you want to have multiple rooms in your identity house. So yeah, there's a room that's the running room, and that might be a really big room. But is there also the spouse room, or the parent room, or the teacher room, or the book club room, or the gardening room, or the yoga room, or the neighbor room, so on and so forth? And that way, when there's a disruption in one room, you can go seek stability in the others. So that's the first big thing I would say about like a rugged and flexible identity for being an athlete, is have multiple rooms in your identity. And it's okay to care a lot about the running room, and it's okay to spend a lot of time in the running room. You just never want to completely neglect the others. You don't want mold to grow in the other rooms. You want to at least go visit them, so that when a change happens in the running room, they're there for you. And then the second big piece here is the difference between a being orientation and a having orientation. So this comes from the mid-1900s psychoanalyst Erich Fromm. And he defines having is when just that, you define yourself by what you have. So you have this amount of money, you have this big house. In the case of running, I have this PR. I have this training plan. And he said that when you define yourself by what you have, you're inherently fragile because those things will always change. So I have this PR until aging catches up to you. I have this training plan until there's an injury or there's a family event that calls for you to need to shift. Whereas if you define yourself in a being orientation, this is much more about like who you are and what you value. And I think this is the difference between saying, I'm a 301 marathoner or a 259 marathoner, and I'm a runner. And maybe even one level up is I'm an athlete. Because when you're an athlete, you're a lot less fragile, because you could happen what happened to me, and it sounds like what happened to Julie at some point, which is sustain an injury that takes you out of the sport, or at least takes you out of the sport in the way you used to be in it. But instead of having this massive identity crisis, you can still be an athlete and you can be an athlete in other ways. So I think those are like the two big, big points here.
Well, first of all, to our listeners, we did not speak to Brad before we recorded our podcast episode last week, because this is exactly what we talked about to our listeners last week, the importance of not identifying with your race times, because that's not why you run, and you're not a runner, you are a person who runs. And there is distinction in that. And we appreciate your analogy with the rooms, because it makes perfect sense to us. And you coach an athlete who certainly embodies that. Do you want to talk a little bit about who that is and what she's done to create rooms for herself?
Yeah. Which athlete are you talking about? Because there's a few that are in public.
Shalane.
Yeah. So to be fair, I'm not currently coaching Shalane, but I've worked with Shalane. If anything, now I'd categorize our relationship as good friends. And I've helped her on and off throughout her career. So I'm biased because she is a good friend. I think Shalane Flanagan is probably the greatest women's distance runner ever. Although there are many others that could be in contention. Dina Castor comes to mind, Kara Gusher, but she's certainly up there, if not the best. And Shalane struggled with retirement. There's no other way to put it. It's really, really hard to give your all to a sport, in her case, to become the face of a sport for a nation, and then to realize that your body is no longer going to let you perform at the level that you want to perform at. And a big part of my work with Shalane was helping her diversify her identity before that transition. Not that it was going to make the transition easy, not that she would experience no grief or depression, but just trying to make it not so intense. And I think Shalane is an exemplary example of this. So she got really into cooking and cookbooks, and she started writing these cookbooks. And then she realized that what she really liked about that was connecting with younger women runners around the importance of proper fueling, because there's such a high prevalence of disordered eating and eating disorders in the running community. And then she's like, well, I really like working with younger runners, so maybe I'll start coaching. So then she talked to Jerry, her coach, about like shadowing him as an assistant coach. And she'd also been, I don't want to say putting off, that's not the right word, but she'd been prioritizing running as such that it didn't make sense for her to start a family, but she really wanted to start a family. So then her and her husband adopted their first kid. So it's not to say that when you retire, you should adopt a kid, but the point is, Shalane was very forward thinking about, this is who I was, but there's more to me, and I need to start opening those other doors and spending time in them, so that when I do retire, I'll have other rooms that I can exist in. And Shalane will be the first to say that her retirement was still very, very hard, but it wasn't as hard as it would have been had she not had these other things to fulfill her.
So Brad, what advice would you give somebody who maybe is in, you know, not as forward thinking, and they're going through a big change and they didn't create all these other rooms ahead of time? What happens when you're in the middle of a change and maybe you're a runner who's now injured and that's all you had was running? Can you do it retroactively? What do you do at that point?
Well, I think that to keep the metaphor going, you can do a renovation or you can make an addition to your house. And I think one of the best times to make an addition is when you're injured. Because suddenly you have all this time and energy that was put into running, to go try to find something else that you can do. Whether that is joining a book club or gardening or cooking, volunteering. I mean, the list goes on and on. So the first thing I'd say is like, add on to your house. And the nice thing about this is that unlike an actual house, you can do it relatively quickly. The second thing that I would say is to be kind and compassionate to yourself. It sucks being injured, especially if running is central to who you are and how you make sense of the world. And to recognize that in that process of order, disorder, reorder, like when you're in the thick of disorder, it sucks. And the last thing you want to do is judge yourself. Like, it's such a common thing, like, oh, you know, I have a house over my head, I'm not in poverty, my life is good, but I'm sitting here Debbie Downer because I pulled my hamstring. And that's just not useful. Like, it could be, oh, my life is good, and I'm really sad that I pulled my hamstring because running matters a lot to me and I really cared about this race. And I think that being kind to ourselves when we're in the midst of that is good. And then also just being patient. knowing that when we're in the thick of like the disorder period, time seems like it slows down. But when we get to the other side of it and we look back on it, it was never that bad. And I think any runner that's experienced even a moderate injury knows that like those first couple weeks when you're away from the sport, it just feels like for freaking ever. But then a year later, you look back at that 2 month period and it feels like time just flew. And just taking consolation in that, it's not going to make it suck any less, but you'll know like, oh, it sucks and it feels like this is forever, but I know I can get to the other side of it. And when I do, it won't seem like it was so all consuming.
And that's a nice transition to another huge component of navigating change. And that is recognizing your expectations and the reality and figuring out a way to manage those. Because of course, you mentioned the injury thing. If someone gets injured and they have high expectations of themselves and they expect to meet a certain barometer, and then the reality is they're not only are they dealing with the injury, but they're also dealing with the disappointment in themselves over that injury. And then that segues into something you talk about that I think is very important, not just among runners, but among everyone, especially in the area we live in. There are a lot of people that call themselves type A. And in doing so, they sort of label themselves perfectionists. And perfectionists tend to have high expectations. And when the reality doesn't meet those expectations, things can start to spiral, including things related to change. So can you talk a little bit about that and how that helps one manage change when they manage those expectations and reality?
For sure. Let's start with an analogy that every runner will know. Mile 20 of the marathon. So if I'm a new runner and I'm doing my first marathon and, you know, Julie or Lisa, one of you are coaching me, what would you tell me about how I'm going to feel at mile 20 of the marathon?
You're
going to
feel like crap.
All right. I'm going to feel like
probably, that's when things get challenging. That's when you have to get strong. And because that's when the race really starts. We usually tell people that's when the race really starts.
Right. So if I'm going to feel like crap and I get to mile 20 and I get there and I feel like crap, okay, I'm ready. I'm prepared. I know what's coming. Imagine if you told me that I should feel really good at mile 20 and that was my expectation. Well, when I get to mile 20, I would freak out. I'd think that something is wrong and I'd probably drop out of the race. Same race, same body, same exact feeling, different expectations, completely different results. So our expectations are so important as to the decisions that we make in reality. There's an offhand equation that psychologists like to use that says that our happiness or our mood at any given point of time is a function of our reality minus our expectations. So if our reality is mile 20 sucks, but our expectations are mile 20 is going to be great, well, then our happiness is going to be very negative when we get to mile 20. And this plays out for all areas of our life, that when we have an expectancy for something and then there's a change, well, by definition, reality is different than what we thought it would be like. And the longer it takes us to update our expectations to be in alignment with reality, the harder it is, the more we suffer. And pragmatically, we can't do anything productive about the situation because we're working on an imaginary situation, not what's actually happened. So how do you take this concept that maybe makes sense intellectually, but apply it? Very simple, like a change to the training plan because of an injury. I mean, I think this is the most practical, common example for runners, which is you've got your plan, you want to stick to it. You're very type A, like Julie said, and suddenly like there's a tweak and there's an injury. Well, your expectation is that you're going to nail your plan, but the reality is now you can't. So you have one of two choices. You either don't update your expectations, and what do you do in that situation? You keep training based on the plan and you make your injury worse. And now what would have been a 1 week or 2 week thing becomes a 1 month or 2 month thing. Or you update your expectations and you say, hey, reality is that I tweaked my Achilles and I can't do this track workout. So I'm going to do an easy runner. I'm going to do a pool workout. I'm going to go on the elliptical for 3 days. I'm going to trust my coaches. That's why I pay them. And then in 2 weeks, I'm going to come back and I'm going to hop right back on the plan and it will make no discernible difference in the race that's still X amount of time down the road. I think another way that this manifests for runners is on race day. So nobody expects that they're going to cramp up. Nobody expects that the weather is going to suck. Nobody expects that their going to go out way too fast. So when these things happen, do you freak out and does it totally throw you off? Do you hold on to your old expectation of what you thought would happen? Or are you able to update and say, all right, you know, there's a massive headwind. That 7:45 pace that Lisa told me I should run, like, it doesn't make sense because it feels like 7-minute pace. So I need to dial things back. And like, I'm no longer racing for a PR because the conditions are different. I'm racing to run a good race. That is the mature thing. You've shifted your expectations to match reality. The immature thing is to say, nope, like, I am hellbent. I'm going under 350. So I'm going to keep this pace, even though there's a 40-mile-an-hour wind gust, and you end up blowing up at mile 15. You probably don't finish the race.
Yeah, something else we also have seen over the years, and we've kind of changed our approach to race prep, is if we give runners a pacing plan that kind of assumes ideal conditions and everything's going as planned. If we give them a pacing plan and we give it to them throughout the race, if the time, let's say they get to mile 20, we tell them you should be at mile 20 by 3 hours, and they get to mile 20 and it's 3:05, they shut down. They say, all right, well, I failed. I'm not at mile 20 by 3 hours like Lisa and Julie told me should be. I failed, and they kind of give up. So we've sort of started changing our plans for runners and giving them that flexibility so that they don't have these expectations. And if they don't hit the expectations, they say, my race is over.
Right. And I think that part of what I'm trying to do with this book, like, if it's just for a runner's audience, is just that. It's back to this core construct, rugged flexibility. So like, what's the rugged part of your race plan? And is it feeling really good? Is it finishing strong? Is it leaving all your fitness out on the course and expressing your fitness from training? Is it making good decisions? For a more advanced runner, is it trying to stay with the lead pack? For a brand new runner, is it trying to run more than I walk? But notice that, like, none of these things are 3:29 or 2:59, because that makes you fragile, because a million things could happen that could throw you off. And it could throw you off in either direction. You know, we talked a lot about the negative, the headwind. Well, what about the opposite, the tailwind? So now suddenly you're supposed to run 7:45 pace, but you're running 7:20s because there's a huge wind at your back. Well, do you freak out and intentionally force yourself to slow down? Or do you say, holy crap, like, the gods aligned and this is the day, and you really go for it? And I think that's where the flexibility comes in. So I think, like, the rugged part of the race plan is kind of, what are you going for beyond just some objective number? And then the flexibility part is, how do you then adapt to the changing circumstances to try to hit that goal?
So turning this on its head, what do you say to the folks, though, who constantly have low expectations because there's a fear of disappointing themselves? So I'm not going to try, or I was training really hard for this, but, you know, I'm just going to take it easy today. What do you say to that group of individuals?
Yeah, it's a great question. I don't think the answer is to set low expectations. I think it's to have accurate expectations and to update your expectations when reality shifts. And to that individual, I'd say you're doing yourself a disservice, because the reality is that you are fit and that, like, you have some good fitness and you're scared of success. And this is like a whole other coaching/therapy session. But ultimately, I think for that person, what they're really scared of is failing. And the thing I like to use to illustrate this point is, if you think back to middle school gym class, remember, like, the really cool kids in middle school, they never tried hard.
I was one of them. No, I'm just kidding.
They never tried hard in gym class. Like, they were quote unquote too cool to try. Well,
that would not be Lisa and me.
Right. Well, why were they too cool to try? Why didn't they try? Because if they tried and they didn't win, they'd be like a failure. And they were basically scared to have that happen. And I think that as an adult, hopefully we can outgrow that. And we can say that, yeah, like, part of the joy and the highs of really giving something your all and caring, there's another side of that coin, which is, things don't always go our way. But that's, like, that's just the price to pay for putting yourself in the arena and caring deeply. And whatever temporary sadness you'll have if you don't hit your goal, you'll be grateful that you gave it your all. So I'm a big believer in, like, the goal of human life isn't to optimize on pleasure or good feelings in the moment. The goal is to, like, live a textured, meaningful life. And if you never fail, you're never going to do that, because that means you'll have never really gone for it.
That's great advice, Brad. I'm kind of thinking, as you're talking about these examples, and I'm wondering what your perspective is on the role of social media in these expectations and are, I mean, you see it on Strava, you're seeing people's paces, you're seeing what they're doing, you're seeing on, you know, Instagram, you're seeing on social media. What, how do you think that plays into this, and what can, I mean, anyone do, but specifically runners do to kind of get out of that cycle?
I'd say unfollow all the runners that you follow on social media, unless they are a benefit to you. So if you are getting good content and you're enjoying and you're learning or you're finding it really inspirational, social media is great. If you are following people and you're feeling great about yourself and then you see their little reel and now suddenly you feel not so good about yourself, I wouldn't follow that person. Here's an example from my own life, no longer in running. So I mentioned that I had this injury that really essentially ended my career as a quasi-competitive runner about 5.5 years ago. I had surgery. The surgery was effective enough where now I can like hike and enjoy that, but I still can't really run. I can't train. So I switched to strength training, and my genetics are very good for strength training. Running, I was always fighting against my body. Strength training, I just like, I have very good genetics. So this is all a setup to say for the last 2.5 years, I've been training pretty seriously, like 4 days a week on a good program with a good coach. And I deadlifted 500 pounds. And it was the biggest clean, so I don't take steroids or anything, was the biggest clean deadlift in my gym in Asheville. And I felt great. I felt like it was a big goal. I felt like I was like competitive. It was just like a really good feeling. And then that night I was scrolling Instagram and I saw all these bros deadlifting like 650 pounds. And I remember thinking like, fuck, like I'm not really even good at this. Like, and it just took all the wind out of my sails, which is so outrageous. And I think like, that's not because I'm weak. I write books on this. It's because like, that's just what happens. And it used to be that we compared ourselves to the people in our local community. So even if I didn't have the strongest deadlift in my gym, I knew the person who did, and I knew how they got there, and I knew if they were a good person or a bad person, and there was a sense of community involved in it. So when you were at the best, it's partially because you're comparing yourself to, you know, X amount of people in one pool. And when you weren't the best, at least you knew the people who were. Whereas now we're comparing ourselves against the entire world and like artificial intelligence created videos, like we don't even know it's real anymore. So I think one of the worst things to do is to spend time on social media if you are going to use it to compare yourself, because you will always find someone that is significantly better at what you do that can make you feel bad. Whereas if you use it in a way to learn and to be inspired, then I think it can be a positive tool. And I think it's just being very liberal with like the unfollow button, or if these are your good friends or your sister that's making you feel miserable, the mute button. Because then they won't know that you unfollowed them.
That's terrific advice. I listen to your podcast a lot, and with Steve Magnus, and that's one of the things you both talk about a lot is cultivating your social media so that it's creating positive energy in your life and you're learning something from it. Because just like with people, you are the company you keep. If you consume social media that creates a negative force in your life, then you will eventually become a negative force in your life.
Yes. I could not agree more. And I think that everyone has a different relationship with it. For me, to be honest, I'm kind of at a point where I really just use it to share my work. I don't really follow any of even my friends because I want to talk to them on the phone or hang out with them. I don't want like the social media version, and I don't want that to be a replacement or to even like have us think for a minute it's a replacement for a real friendship. So I basically now just view it as a way to share my work. But all of my actual relationship building and my actual, like friendships and when I'm going to compare, my actual comparisons are to real people in the real world. And it's not to say that like the internet is bad, because some of this is just not people that live in my geography, but I've moved much more to like the group text. And I just find that for my mental health, that makes a lot more sense than social media.
Good reminder. We're both parents, and you're a parent. You mentioned that at the beginning. How are you helping your kids learn these lessons? And how are you, I mean, obviously you're demonstrating it by the way you live, but how do we help our kids learn these lessons and learn to be ruggedly flexible?
Yeah, I think that it's just don't talk about it, be about it is really it. Like, it's the most important thing from all the parenting research that I've seen is like, your kids are just always watching you. So you can sit there and tell them about the value of responding, not reacting. But then if you snap every time there's a change, well, that's what they're going to learn to do. So that's the first thing, is really just try to role model it. And then the second thing is, I'm just trying to like introduce some of these terms and concepts in an age appropriate way, to my kids. I guess not to my 9 month old, she can't understand anything, but to my 5.5 year old. So yeah, maybe we don't talk about rugged flexibility, but maybe we talk about how, when something doesn't go the way you want, there's a part of you that like really wants to hold on tight and really wants to care about it. And that's because like it matters to you, and that's a big part of who you are. But then there's another part of you that says, well, like if I were just to let go, maybe the rest of the day wouldn't be so bad. And you can also let go. And like, you can do both those things at the same time. We talk about this a lot. I don't know how old your kids are, but like almost 6-year-old boy is at this phase where everything's a competition, and you're going to lose sometime. And I don't want to tell him that like, oh, it's okay. But what we've talked about too is like, would it be fun if every time you won? No, it'd be boring. So part of what makes playing games so much fun is that sometimes you lose, and it's okay to want to win, but you can lose. So really just trying to teach like this non-dual thinking that like you can want something and let it go.
And you mentioned before, we were going to talk about this, when you talk to your kids, you talk about the difference between, well, kid, not your 9.5 month old, reacting versus responding. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because we all know this as adults, but you lay it out very nicely in your book on how to do that.
So reacting is, it's very like hot, emotionally hot, instinctual. It's like when we snap. You know, it's like, I snapped on my partner, I snapped on my kid, or I snapped on myself. And we never really feel too good after we do that. Responding is slower, it's colder, it's much more deliberate and thoughtful. We rarely regret when we respond to something. So then the question, of course, becomes, well, how do you try to respond instead of react? And every book like mine needs a framework. So here I have one. I talk about how reacting is the 2 P's. So you panic and then you pummel ahead. And responding is the 4 P's. So you pause, just take a breath or two, you process. Research shows the best way to do this is just to name your emotion, to name what you're feeling. So say, I'm feeling angry, I'm feeling frustrated, I'm feeling despair, I'm feeling sad, I'm feeling empty, I'm feeling excited, I'm feeling overjoyed, I'm feeling rushed. When we name what we're feeling, we separate ourselves from it. So it literally creates space. Then after we process, we make a plan. So we say, all right, like here, back to our earlier conversation, here were my expectations for what were going to happen. Here's what actually happened. Now, what resources do I have to deal with it? And then only then do you proceed. And what I love about this is notice that it takes me about a split second to explain panic and pummel ahead, because that's what reacting is. It's reactionary. It's a split second. And just by going through the 4 P's, you're expanding, you're creating some space and some time, and it gives you a chance to get out of that reactionary snap mode and into a more thoughtful, discerning one. No one's perfect. We're wired to react. I think that's really important to know. Like, our evolution set us up to react, because we evolved at a time when there were predators trying to get us. And if you see a snake, you don't want to be too thoughtful and deliberate. You see a tiger, you certainly don't want to. But nowadays, it tends to be like a kid, you know, melting down, or a dog having diarrhea, not a tiger or a snake. And I think responding tends to make more sense.
And then, of course, in the running context, it comes to mind, when you're in a race and things aren't going well, what can you do right now? How can you respond? Pause.
Process. Yep. Plan, proceed. I think like a great example, there's 2 great examples from a running context. I think the first is, you miss an aid station, or the aid station doesn't go as well as you think. So you don't get as much water as you think you do. You don't get the gel. I can't tell you what the right answer is. That's what makes it hard. Like, sometimes the right answer is to say, you know, my body's resilient, I've been fueling well, I'm equipped, screw it. Like, I'm just going to keep going. Other times, though, if you go through that process, the right answer might be, I really, really, really want to hit this time, but I know like, I don't think I can go 2 more miles without some caffeine and sugar. Like, I need to turn around and spend an extra 10 seconds making sure I get that whole gel in. So I don't know what the right answer is, but I know that it's better to quickly respond to that than just to react and freak out. Another great example is you go out too fast or too slow, but I think it happens more often too fast. Well, what do? I don't know. Maybe you're just feeling on fire that day and you should stick to the pace because you're going to have an out of body experience. Maybe you need to slow down to your normal race pace. Maybe you need to adjust even further down, or you go out too slow. Well, do you freak out and try to make that mile back? Another example that any runner who wears a GPS watch will experience is, you know, you're looking at your watch to get your pacing and suddenly you realize that mile 13 was 1.1 miles instead of 1 mile, even though the dumb Chicago Marathon people said it's 1 mile. Well, do you like freak out and try to make up a lot of time? Or do you assume that the person measuring this certified course actually is more accurate than your GPS and you just keep running your race? So there's countless opportunities to practice responding, not reacting. During a training session, you feel a little tug in your calf and you're on repeat number 5 out of 8, you know, 5 by 400, you were supposed to do 8. Well, you tell me, I don't know if you're supposed to finish the workout or not. It's going to depend on who you are, where you're at in your training, how bad the niggle was, but what you don't want to do is freak out. So you get countless opportunities to practice this both in training and in racing.
Super helpful. As we mentioned to you offline, we have a lot of runners, obviously, who listen to our podcast, but also a lot of parents, and just everyone navigates change all through their life. And I think your book is such a gift because it not only shows us real examples on how to navigate change, but also normalizes change. I think a lot of our problems in our world are when we try so hard to resist change, and you kind of turn it on its framework and say, change is what life is about. And here's how to navigate it when it's not a positive change and it's not something you expect. And it's just a great book. So before we let you go, please share with our listeners where to find you, particularly your podcast, social media, of course, and the name of your book and where people can purchase it.
Thank you. The book is called Master of Change, How to Excel When Everything is Changing, Including You. If you found the conversation interesting, I can almost guarantee that you'll love the book. It is available wherever you get books, from Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Books A Million, your local bookstore. It's also on Audible if you prefer to listen to books. And the place where I am most on the internet these days is probably Instagram, and I am at Brad Stahlberg. And then my podcast is the Growth Equation Podcast, which, as you mentioned, I co-host with Steve Magnus.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Brad. We've been wanting to have you on our podcast for a couple of years, and we're so honored that you were able to join us today. And we very much appreciate your words of wisdom as well as your book. Folks, get a copy. It's a wonderful book. So thank you for joining us today, Brad.
Thank you so much, Julie and Lisa, for having me.
Thank you so much for listening to the Run Farther and Faster Boston Marathon podcast. We want to give a special thanks to our editor, Aaron Bryant. And if you enjoyed this episode and enjoy listening to our podcast, please share it with others. And please leave a review if you haven't done so already on iTunes. Thanks for listening and have a great week.